This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and happy 2021, our maiden show in the year 2021. Hope everybody had a lovely holiday. And
Everything's different now, right? It's 2021. We say goodbye to 2020 and all the problems that, you know, are associated with it.
Right. We find ourselves on this Monday, January 4th, in the same place we found ourselves before Christmas, which is discussing the outcome of the election, the various challenges to it. Some of the avenues to challenge have, at this point, more or less been foreclosed, but there's still one left, and that happens on Wednesday when Congress meets to count the votes. But before we even get to that and the objections that are going to be lodged by a dozen senators and more than 100 members of the House, let us take up the something else that smacks of 2020, frankly. 2019 and 2020, which is impeachment. It's been impeachment at the outset for President Trump as it pertains to the Democrats and their handmaidens in the media, and it remains impeachment even potentially as his presidency sunsets because of this phone call that he had with counsel with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger over the weekend. This was essentially something akin to a settlement conference with respect to the litigation that has been filed by the Trump campaign in Georgia with respect to the count there, trying to see if they can get particular information that has not been made available to them by the Secretary of State's office, meaning the Trump campaign, seeing if they can get the Secretary of State's office to investigate irregularities that they don't believe the Trump campaign has been properly, thoroughly investigated. And so, of course, this hour-long conversation immediately is turned around and leaked to the Washington Post. And now we're in Zelensky Redux and impeachment calls Redux because of the way that Trump speaks about these things.
Right. And leading the charges, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin wants a criminal investigation opened this morning.
Mm-hmm. Here is some pertinent parts that Democrats are staking their claims to. Abuse of power. Remember that phrase? Mm-hmm. It seems like
so long ago.
Last year, last 2 years, but no, it's back here and at the advent of 2021. Abuse of power, blackmailing, attempts to blackmail Secretary of State Raffensperger. Some of the pertinent clips, including this rather inartful articulation of a lot of what Trump relayed in that conversation that was very specific.
The people of Georgia are angry. And these numbers are going to be repeated on Monday night, along with others that we're going to have by that time, which are much more substantial even. And the people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is prima facie blackmail, according to Democrats. Do we agree?
Well, they say it's an assault on our democracy. I mean, it's an hour, an hour, 4 minutes long. I listened to the whole thing. It sounded like, to be completely honest, a desperate man just trying to see, he's getting information that's different from their information. And another person on the phone call was an attorney named Ryan German, and he tried to explain it to Trump.
No, Dominion has not moved any machinery out of Fulton County. We're having
Have they moved the inner parts of the machines and replace them with other parts?
No.
You sure, Ryan?
I'm sure.
I mean, it's kind of sad. I mean, I feel bad for President Trump. It's hard to lose. I understand that. But they're saying that they can't make up those votes because those votes aren't there. And that's, did you feel that way at all, Dan, when you listened to it, that he seemed a little desperate?
I think he was Trumping Trump. This is how Trump talks. If you go through, the transcript is posted, so it's easy to go through and pick off the things that he said specifically. But he goes through how many votes they allege were people who had voted who were no longer eligible to vote because they had moved. How many people who voted who were dead, and they say it was several thousand. Raffensperger says it was two. Mark Meadows, the chief of staff who was on the call, chimed in on this. They go through the number of ballots they believe should have been spoiled because of lack of signatures on the absentee ballot application, so on and so forth. There's a specificity. The Dominion thing, they set aside. They don't really even spend much time talking about that. It is all about these batches of dubious votes and or ballots from voters. They talk about affidavits they have from people who showed up to vote and said, you can't vote, you already voted. And they said, no, I didn't already vote. Right. Affidavit, another irregularity, another category of irregularities.
Now, why aren't those 1,700 people arrested, by the way, that voted twice in Georgia?
So there's all these specifics, which has been my lament throughout. And there are specifics lodged there. And if you go through the call, you hear from Cleta Mitchell, who is a very, very well-respected because she's a very, very good election attorney. You've heard her on our show before. Here's one thing that she said, and I'm quoting from the transcript, so this is verbatim. The people of Georgia and the people of America have a right to know the answers, and you have data and records that we don't have access to. And you keep telling us and making public statements that you investigated this and nothing to see here, but we don't know about that. All we know is what you tell us. What I don't understand is why wouldn't it be in everyone's best interest to try to get to the bottom, compare the numbers, you know, if you say because to try to get to be able to get to the truth, because we don't have any way of confirming what you're telling us. You tell us that you had an investigation at the State Farm Arena. I don't have any report. I've never seen a report of investigation. I don't know what it is. I've been pretty involved in this, and I don't know. And that's just one of like 25 categories. And it doesn't even, as I and the president said, I haven't even gotten into the Dominion issue. That's not part of our case. Her point, her overarching point is with respect to the back and forth on this call about we say 5,000, you say two in a particular category. That's what you say. We can't see the data. We have our information that we'd like to present and bump up against your information that only you have access to. But you won't let us see that because you say under law we're not allowed to see that. Well, so there's no way to reconcile the information we have with the information you say you have unless the two are integrated, is the point that she is making on behalf of President Trump and the campaign. And it's a good one. And ultimately, all of the bluster aside, you get down to it between the attorneys representing both sides. And they say, look, we've got 24,000, round numbers here, 24,000 where we say we would like to bump up against your, essentially, the information only you hold, Secretary of State's office, to find out if we're right or you're right. And one of Trump's attorneys says, hey, if you're right, you're right. But we've got these 24,000 votes that have been audited by accounting firms, that have been looked at by election experts, and we say that there's 24,000 votes that shouldn't have been counted. And you say that's not true. So the only way we can reconcile this is if we get together and we're allowed to have access to your information, even privately, even under an NDA, so that we can get an answer to this question. And it would be in your interest to answer this question so that we could come out and say, you know what, this cohort of 24,000 ballots, we bumped it up against their information. They provided the information to us, and this was the result. And we'll accept whatever result comes from that, essentially, audit of our audited number. That's something they could do. And so they seem to come to agreement, but not at the end of the call. There's agreement. Like, the attorneys will get together today and try to figure out a time to meet in advance. And Trump obviously wants it in advance of tomorrow's election because it could be material in terms of encouraging people to come out and vote, or particularly those that are otherwise throwing up their hands. But the Secretary of State's office does not concede, and they make their one of their attorneys makes clear. I think it was Germany makes clear that we're not necessarily agreeing to give you access to the data that you say you need to vet your cohort of 24,000 vote challenges. So it's an interesting dance that's done here. But if you could, you know, get through all of the blather, which is why you listen to this show, to cut through all of the nonsense you hear on Sunday talkies and the overheated tweets and all this stuff. That's what really what the call came down to. We have, Fulton County this and State Farm Arena that and Dominion that. Ultimately, the attorney said 24,000. This is our challenge here. We want to bump up our 24,000 audited challenge votes that we believe were improperly counted against your system to see if we're right on whatever it is, the combination of the number of dead and the number of move-outs and the number of signature mismatches and so forth, whatever the component parts of that 24,000 is. And then we'll accept whatever the result is, which is actually a pretty reasonable position, I think, by the Trump campaign.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, or you could text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Rich in Indian Head Park.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Glad to have you guys back. Happy 2021. I just have a simple question. How do these phone calls that the president has get leaked to the media?
Secretary of State's office leaked it, obviously. Well, the Secretary of State's office, I mean, the Trump side didn't leak it, so the Secretary of State's office leaked it, clearly, and that's why Trump is actually suing. There was an announcement made that he is filing suit against the Secretary of State's office for leaking the audio.
Good.
I mean, it seems like every time they have he has an important call or something that they think isn't right, they leak it to the media, and now you have this big blow-up that he's trying to bribe the Secretary of State to change the voting and... What you just explained makes a lot of sense. I think they should give him a chance to at least hear his case.
Thanks, Rich. And just so you know, if you listen to the whole thing or read the transcript, he talks about I believe I won Georgia by 500,000 votes, and he goes through all these particulars. So this idea is like we believe we lost, but can you find 11,780 votes that we need to win? That's not what's happening on that call. That's not what he's asserting. He's asserting we won by exponentially more than that number, and here's all the categories that explain why I believe that. And all I'm looking for, I don't need to get into Dominion. I don't need to get into every single area, because if you just looked at a couple of these areas, it puts us over the top. That's essentially what he's trying to say. But, you know, it's a jumbled mess, to be quite honest about it, over the course of an hour. And he should have let his attorneys do more talking than he did. And he should have, frankly, let the Secretary of State's office folks do a little bit more talking, too. It was a little bit like the first debate. He was interrupting his opponent while they were when he could have given them a chance to could have given them a chance to undo themselves. Philip in Blue Island.
You stole my point. I think you did just over talk. And like I said, he was asking some important questions, but, you know, the Dominion piece. And then the lawyer did ask him about, I guess it was the conspiracy theories or the media sources that he was getting his numbers from. And he really didn't have a good answer, or he just kind of got angry at the question. And so, again, he was just doing too much talking, and he wasn't allowing them.
Yeah, Philip, it's nice. It's a rare agreement. We start the new year in agreement. All right, Philip, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. He just said, like Raffensperger said, something akin to, you know, you're getting your information, and there's a lot of information on social media that's inaccurate and so on and so forth. And he said, I'm not getting my information from social media. It's your media. It's the Biden media. I'm not getting information from that. I'm getting information that we've cobbled together through my team, and as again has been audited by the appropriate professionals. David in Lansing.
Hi, citizen journalist here. I have two abuses of power the Washington Compost can look into. One is the Washington Compost, owned by Amazon, controlled by Jeff Bezos, going to play Joe Biden's widely available clip on the internet where he's standing in front of the CFR telling everybody that he
wanted to get Ukraine. Right, yes, right.
Yeah, get the prosecutor fired. To lay off his crackhead son. And here's another thing for the Washington Compost to look into. Douglas C. Emhoff is Kamala Harris's husband. Douglas C. Emhoff works at DLA Piper Global. Smartmatic partnered with DLA Piper Global. That means Kamala Harris has connections to the voting machines. Washington Compost. Look into it, Washington Compost.
All right, David. Thanks for the call. Chuck from Delavan.
Well, it was nice to have him say Washington Compost.
Hold on, Chuck.
Chuck's on the Munchkin line.
Get Chuck to call back on one of the phone lines that we have that works, and we'll take him after the news.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about hype over Trump's call with Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, and his legal team, Trump and his legal team. And, of course, the D.C. press corps dutifully missing the crux of the issue in order to demagogue the president, the crux of the issue being that we're told to just take the Georgia Secretary of State's word on some of these election irregularities because there is this impasse between the Trump campaign's audited information, they assert, as to really 24,000 is where their focus is, votes that should have been counted. And their inability to get access to the information only the Secretary of State's office has to bump up their file against the Secretary of State's file to see who's right.
And Trump even asked, too, you know, he didn't get into Dominion too much, but he asked about possible shredded ballots that he heard about.
You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan. Your lawyer, that's a big risk.
And the mainstream media saw that as a threat. You know, he's threatening them if they don't overturn the election. No, he's not threatening them. He's saying, you know, this is a risk because guess what tomorrow is? The two runoff elections to decide who has control of the U.S. Senate.
I want to get to what happens on Wednesday. So this is a predicate to not only Tuesday and that the Georgia runoffs, but also a predicate to Wednesday. And Tuesday is also a predicate to Wednesday. But with the action over the weekend by announcement over the weekend by Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and a dozen U.S. senators, Republican senators, and more than 100 members of the House. We'll take a couple more calls on the call, and then let's bridge to that conversation about who's right, because there's some, I think, conservatives in good standing, generally speaking, that have different opinions about whether or not there should be an objection to the election outcomes on Wednesday by Republicans. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know what got Trump triggered was this guy is just like every politician. He wasn't even listening to Trump. He just kept whatever Trump said. It was like Trump was playing tennis off a wall. That's what got him going. And then aside, over the holiday, I was watching the Zoom meeting of Biden with all of his staff, and it was like the Hollywood Squares dysfunctional.
Was Whoopi in the middle?
No. But everybody just sat in stunned silence. This guy went on forever. He was just rambling, telling about, you know, the adventures of Corn Pop and Finger Pop. You know, it was horrible. You have to see it. I'm almost glad that he won. The material's going to be limitless.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Ed in Oak Brook.
Yeah, you know what? I've been watching YouTube. In fact, I've been consumed by this whole thing, and I don't trust the mainstream media, as we all should not. But the voting switching by in the middle of the night, where they actually show it, data experts from Trump to Biden. Can you ever explain that? The guy said this should not happen. Did they ever explain why the data was erased in Michigan? They're supposed to keep it for 22 months, 24 months, whatever. This data was erased. They never did explain how 2.5 million mail-in ballots came back in Pennsylvania, but only 1.9 was mailed out. No one has ever explained that. Nevada, they've already showed all of the dead people. Arizona, they actually have a thing going on where they're going house to house or with the ballot and looking at four people that don't even exist, mailing locations. In other words, there's so much evidence. I don't think you can put this all together to make a good case for it because there's just too much there.
Yeah, but, I don't. Okay. Too much evidence. That's a stylish problem. I disagree with that. I think part of the failure of the Trump legal team over the last 6 weeks has been it's been beset by people who are not acting in concert with one another. Sidney Powell, Lynn Wood, who were Sidney Powell really effectively was a member of the team, and then she became sort of a de facto strategic ally, whatever. Those two became sideshows. I said at the beginning I would give them the benefit of the doubt because they have such impressive records, her as a federal prosecutor, Lynn Wood as a defense attorney in high-profile cases, as we've discussed, Jewell, Sandman. But I also said that they're putting their credibility on the line, their professional reputations on the line with the sort of release the Kraken claims that they were making. And Lynn Wood continues to make, as in addition to suggesting that people shouldn't vote in the runoff election tomorrow, which right. is asinine. So they did those things. And I think they greatly damaged, if not irreparably damaged, their reputations. Unhelpful. Also, the failure to take all of this information coming in, decide what is the best argument you have. What are the best arguments that could materially impact the outcome for which you have the most evidence and focus all your energy there rather than sort of the rambling spaghetti against a wall approach, both rhetorically and legally, that was taken. So let's be a little bit honest now. I know people were critical of me in real time for the criticisms I'm lodging today that I lodged for the last several weeks. But now, in retrospect, it could have been done a lot better.
Yeah, I mean,
you needed a bigger legal team. You needed more experts in election law. You needed more preemptive legal action in advance of November 3rd, in addition to legal presence on November 3rd, so you could be in courts of law more quickly than you were on material claims that don't require a lot of moving parts to survive a motion for summary judgment, to get to discovery, to litigate some of these issues about things like out-of-state voters and dead voters and right. Failure to do signature verification and questions about indefinitely confined designations in Wisconsin, for example. All of that stuff could have been happening on parallel tracks if you had the appropriate resources that were strategically laid out ahead of time so they could be activated as necessary.
I mean, even like pro-Trump lawyer Lynn Wood that you mentioned, over the weekend he tweeted that Vice President Mike Pence would face execution if he fails to thwart Congress.
It's ridiculous.
Their certification of President-elect Joe Biden. He was on another show I was listening, and he was saying that Chief Justice was on Jeffrey Epstein's plane. It's just crazy.
I get it. Right. That's the whole point.
That's a sideshow. That's a distraction. And they took away from
and
the
for those
issues.
Who And those who them. Want... Yeah, those who wanted to sort of like default... I get giving some benefit of the doubt initially, but when you go screaming into the wilderness, as Lynn Wood did... And continues to do. Then I'm sorry. What is the end game? You think he's advancing? And of course, he is grabbed onto by the press corps, just as some of Trump's offhanded comments over the course of an hour discussion are grabbed onto to hype, to delegitimize, to undermine, to distract.
Because it makes for great television.
Yeah, I understand why it does that. But Trump should know the media. He does know the media,
yeah,
and his legal team should be sophisticated enough to know that. So they shouldn't be taking the bait that they took over and over again. Unhelpful, not effective. So you have all these questions that go unresolved because there wasn't the sort of focus to resolve them that could have been brought to bear. And yes, I understand who the left is, and I understand who the left media is, but that's built into the price. So don't complain about them when you know what you're up against beforehand and you don't take the steps that you could have taken to be effective against your opponents. They are your opponents. You're asking for people who have said, I am your opponent. I believe the ends justify the means. I will do whatever it takes to remove you from office. And then you're saying, they're not acting fairly. Well, I'm sorry. What is confusing about what they've said and how they behaved for 5 years? Greg and LaGrange, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Greg.
This is what gets. Good morning. Good morning. Welcome back. This is what gets me. The absolute incompetence of this team that was put together by President Trump to fight this case. Now, the Secretary of State of Georgia says he has data, but he won't release it about the election count. How is that possible? So you have.
He argues, just so that people understand the argument, he argues and his lawyers that were on that call argue that they are, you know, bound by state law to not disclose certain voter information that they have. I don't know Georgia state election law well enough to know, but I think the point that was made by the Trump legal team to say, well, look, there's got to be some accommodation we can arrive at that allows us to bump up our information against yours, or you to bump up our information against yours, so that we can get a resolution to this, again, 24,000 universe of ballots that we're challenging for the purposes of that settlement conference, at least. There's got to be a way to resolve that, and it's in your interest to resolve that, in the interest of transparency, in the interest of legitimacy, and I think that's a pretty good argument the Trump campaign is making.
I think it's absolutely absurd that the state of Georgia can sit there and keep these data reports private, claiming the integrity of the data and the people casting their votes, while the entire system is under assault based on mail-out ballots, who signed things, who didn't sign things, whether people were eligible to receive these votes. It's a circular, it's a dog chasing its tail. It's so absurd. It's unbecoming of this republic. And to the person that thought that thinks it might be funny or thinks it might be interesting to see Joe Biden as president, yeah, it might be funny if it was a cartoon strip. Unfortunately, he's leading our republic. It's our republic that's at stake.
Thanks, Greg.
Well, and Brad Raffensperger was on ABC News yesterday and pretty much doubled down on what he had said. He laid it out about why they're not reversing the election count.
Because the results are accurate. We had a verifiable paper ballot trail, and we ran the ballots through, did a hand recount and also machine recount, gave us virtually the same results that President Trump came up short. We've also done a signature match audit in Cobb County, and we found zero cases of absentee ballot signature fraud. Zero cases in Cobb County, and that gives us a 99.99% in that county. So wherever we've had these questions, we've gone ahead and we've done investigations. We've worked with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. We've been very thorough, very thoughtful. We wanted to make sure that the results were accurate, and that's what we believe, the results are accurate.
Yeah, but that is not satisfying to all the questions that remain. And again, Cleta Mitchell, Trump's election attorney, raised the issue. You know, you say you, for example, investigated the State Farm facility incident that was caught on video, and there's nothing to see here. Well, I haven't seen any report on that. So we have to say, we raise an issue, and you say we looked at that, and you're wrong, and we're right. But you don't have to essentially prove up why we're wrong and you're right, and that's a problem. That's not persuasive. We're wrong. We're right because we say we're right. We're right. Just trust us. Well, clearly people don't trust you. And if it's so overwhelmingly obvious that you're right and it's so clear to you that you're right, then you should want to show your work, shouldn't you? Terry in Rogers Park.
Could it be Trump couldn't get any election law experts willing to take his case?
Cleta Mitchell is an election law expert. Cleta, there's no better election attorney in Washington, D.C., for my money, and I know a bit about this, than Cleta Mitchell. She was on that call over the weekend.
Working for him? I thought you said he didn't get any election. He didn't get election law experts.
Well, I would say
Giuliani.
Well, right. Thanks for the call, Terry. Cleta Mitchell is part of that team, but she hasn't played the role that I would have, from what I can glean, I would have had her play. Now, maybe she wanted to play this limited role. I don't know exactly. But it doesn't just rise or fall on Cleta Mitchell. I mean, you're talking about trying to litigate in half a dozen states simultaneously. And I'm not saying that everybody on his team is not an effective attorney or doesn't provide some expertise, provide some value add. But it just wasn't as prepared. It wasn't as robust as it needed to be. And then even that relatively small band of legal representation, I mean, that was a mess over the last month. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to say it. Giuliani and Powell were a mess. And Jenna Ellis, frankly, does not have the chops to be at that level in this moment. She just doesn't. She doesn't have the legal background. Maybe as a spokesperson with a legal background, but not in terms of somebody driving legal strategy. I just say again, talking to Richard Epstein, University of Chicago, Columbia Law, who's one of the most brilliant legal minds in the country, he said, look, if I had been tapped to do this, I would say, I can't do this by myself. I need to bring in these experts in all these other legal disciplines with backgrounds here, because there's no way that I have the experience, the nuanced knowledge to run all these parallel tracks just with a couple of attorneys. No way. Robert in Park Ridge.
Hello. My question is, why is not the Justice Department doing anything about this? Why do they continue to say that there's no evidence of fraud when it's all over the place? Well, how can they do that?
Thanks for the call, Robert. I know that the Trump campaign wanted a Justice Department investigation, but, they're presenting evidence in courts of law at the state and federal level, and U.S. attorneys in those jurisdictions, have decided that there is not enough that rises to the level of opening up formal criminal investigations. Maybe they believe that there were things that happened that were fraudulent, or there were irregularities, but there's not enough evidence to move forward with a criminal investigation, which is a different kettle of fish. That's clearly where they're at. I think much more was made of the Barr statement that I haven't seen any evidence of systemic election fraud than he really intended, which is to say it's really not our purview, generally speaking. And to the extent it's my purview, I defer to my U.S. attorneys in the various jurisdictions. Todd in Lake Geneva.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
My question to you, Dan, is why are voting machines... why are we using voting machines with software? I mean, that right there is a red flag to me. I mean, everything should be done by paper ballot.
Yep.
I had two laptops that were taken over by ransomware. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's plain and simple.
Oh, I would never vote on one of those computers. I'm a paper ballot person. And I was thinking about that over the weekend. Why can't we just get rid of the Dominion voting system? Why can't we just go back to old school? You know, how you just vote on a paper ballot. Stick it in the machine and hope for the best.
Well, I mean, again, let's remember states are state elections are state and local matters. So states could do that. And obviously Dominion is in a handful of states, but it's not in a bunch of other states.
Not in Texas.
So these are choices that have to be made at the local level, too, when thinking about elections prospectively. The focus right now is federal. The focus prospectively should be state and state legislatures. Chuck and Delavan.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road. I can't believe that I went munchkin on my first call of the year. Hey, that's that black hat that's been following me a whole life and my dark cloud that's been following me. Hey, all I wanted to say was I just wanted to ask the big guy upstairs to bless both of you guys and all your listeners on this year. And this is all gonna work out. Thank you very much. God bless you guys.
Thank you, Chuck. We appreciate it. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. A happy 2021. In the immortal words of Ambrose Bierce from the Devil's Dictionary, the definition of year, a period of 365 disappointments. And so now we're on our fourth day of disappointments. Woo! In 2021. So I want to welcome you to that.
Thank you.
January 6th, that would be Wednesday. That is when Congress convenes to count the electoral votes as per the 12th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which is a document that the Democrats sometimes like to reference and other times like to discard, depending on their interest in the moment. The question, though, is the challenges that were announced by a dozen Republican senators, the objections that they're going to lodge, and more than 100 Republican members of the House, is that right and proper? Or is that what the Wall Street Journal editorial board calls a stunt over the Electoral College that will hurt the country and the party? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. And the interesting thing, Amy, is that there are some conservatives who agree with the assertions that the election irregularities are disturbing and require investigation, that dismiss this mantra that there was no systemic election fraud, that Joe Biden won it fair and square. They dismiss that, but yet they don't want to go down this path of formally objecting on Wednesday because they think it will set a dangerous precedent that Democrats will seize upon. One of those individuals is Tom Cotton. Yep. From Arkansas.
Yeah, he said he's not going to. Congress does not have the power to overturn the election results, and that he will not support attempts to stop the certification of the Electoral College votes on Wednesday. Because, again, right, because he said, quote, that it could embolden Democrats who want to destroy the Constitution. And who agrees with that? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
I guess my pushback to Senator Cotton on that score would be, is there anything that doesn't embolden the Democrats? Right. I mean, or is there anything that otherwise restrains the Democrats? You think by not pursuing an objection that somehow the Democrats will not do actually what they've previously done in elections this century, which is to lodge objections? They did it in 2016 after Trump, and they did it in 2004 with respect to the election outcome in Ohio that secured George W. Bush a second term. So the idea that Democrats have some standing here, well, that's laughable, number one. Number two, the idea that anything Republicans do will set any sort of precedent or provide any sort of example for Democrats, I think, is risible. Cotton, though, two other points he made in addition to the one that you just explained. Congress would imperil the Electoral College. Democrats could achieve their longstanding goal of eliminating the Electoral College in effect by refusing to count electoral votes in the future for a Republican presidential elect. That's sort of a corollary to that. Third, Congress would take another big step toward federalizing election law, another longstanding Democratic priority that Republicans have consistently opposed. Well, the counter-argument was offered by a number of senators on the Sunday talkies, including Ted Cruz, who organized the sort of Gang of 11, Josh Hawley sort of, an island unto himself. But then Cruz and 10 other senators who are calling for the establishment, or will call for the establishment, of a bipartisan election commission to investigate the legitimate and outstanding issues of election fraud, to do so and reach some sort of conclusion about those assertions before the January 20th inauguration as set by the Constitution. He thinks that's eminently doable, and there's actually precedent for it, as he explained to Maria Bartiromo.
I think the strongest precedent is the presidential election of 1876, Hayes versus Tilden. In that election, there were serious allegations of fraud in three different states, in Florida, in Louisiana, and in South Carolina. And what did Congress do in 1876? Now, they didn't throw up their hands and say, well, gosh, we've got allegations of fraud, but we can't do anything about it. We've just got to certify. No, they didn't do that.
Yeah.
What they did instead is they appointed a commission. It was called an electoral commission. consisted of five House members, five senators, five Supreme Court justices. They considered evidence, they examined the ballots, and they made a determination based upon what the disputed ballots and what the outcome should be. What I'm arguing for is Congress ought to do the same thing. We ought to have a fair inquiry, a fair audit into these results, and we ought to resolve these claims, not just dismiss them out of hand.
Mm-hmm. And Bartiromo asked the appropriate follow-up question, which is, okay, well, so this commission is convened and there's an investigation into legitimate claims that have some basis and not a sufficient response to this point. And you find evidence of fraud that could materially change the outcome in the elections of particular states, then what?
Well, then the results have to be set aside. If there's evidence of fraud and it's substantial and significant enough to affect the results in a particular state, then those election results would have to be set aside. And the states would then have to determine, all right, we have a valid claim here. The evidence supports it. We need to conduct elections consistent with the law.
All right, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Are you with Cruz or Cotton? Cruz or Cotton, who's it going to be? Tom in Blue Island.
Dan and Amy, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Wanted to tell you that my guys are going back to work today, and I told them we weren't going back to work until Dan and Amy went back to work.
Oh, okay,
so, yeah,
great.
So these roofers have to go out today in this cold because you guys.
Yeah, well, they got to make money just like we do. So there you go.
Yeah, right. Dan, without a doubt, Cruz. I believe one of the great things that's happened over the last 4 years is how much of an honorable man Ted Cruz has proven himself to be. Trump was unfair to Cruz. He was unfair to his family.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Ted Cruz has stood above that, and he has stood above it. Tom Cotton is maddening. These Dan, I'm so tired of these holier-than-thou Republicans. Do they think the Democrats are not going to do anything that they want, regardless of anything that any Republicans could do or would do? But as far as January 6th, I just want to hit a couple real quick points. It has to go through. They have to get as much evidence out there as they can. I think it's a million to one shot that the election's going to be overturned, but they have to expose as much of this as they can so you don't have to perpetually list it and, oh, there wasn't any evidence. Come on, there's been all kinds of evidence.
Thanks for the call, Tom. With respect to Cotton, I don't think Cotton is being holier than thou here. Some Republican senators are, and some are dismissing these claims out of hand, and they are a bit maddening. But I don't think Tom Cotton is one of them, which is why I selected him, because I think he's making a reasonable argument on principle, despite the fact that he is a Trump supporter. And he is not dismissing or diminishing people who are raising these issues of fraud, including his colleagues. Josh Hawley, who was the first to come out last week and say he is going to use his time to object. And that sort of sent well, certainly the Twitterverse spinning, and then, of course, all the talking heads as well, because Hawley is a smart guy. He's a former state attorney general in Missouri before he was a U.S. senator. And so, you know, you can't just dismiss him like they like to dismiss some as just some sort of Trump apologist crank. Hawley was on Fox, and he explained why he is going to use his time and privilege as United States senator to lodge the objection he's going to. His has a wrinkle in it, right? His is raises some of the same issues, makes some of the same points that Ted Cruz was making about fraud allegations generally. But he, of course, also folds in big tech, and that's the wrinkle with Hawley.
Well, first of all, I don't recall hearing the Democrats make any such outrageous claims when they were the ones who were objecting during the Electoral College certification in 2004 and 2016. Democrats have done this for years in order to raise concerns about election integrity. Now when Republicans, 74 million Americans, have concerns about election integrity, we're supposed to just sit down and shut up? I mean, somebody has to stand up here. You've got 74 million Americans who feel disenfranchised, who feel like their vote doesn't matter, and this is the one opportunity that I have as a United States Senator. This process right here, my one opportunity to stand up and say something, and that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Sue in St. Charles.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I completely agree with Holly and Ted Cruz. That is their job. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to uphold the Constitution and serve their constituents. So I couldn't agree with them more. If they don't oppose this now, then the Democrats are just going to run ripshod over everybody all the time, because it's just like a kid that does something wrong or gets away with something. They're going to do it again and again and again. So I agree completely.
Thanks for the call, Sue.
But, yeah, Dan, is this going to change the result of the election, though? Or is it just going to delay it? Because they're going to spend, what, up to 2 hours debating the objections to each state's results.
That's right. That's what can be done. Is it likely to change the results of the election? No, it's highly unlikely. But is that the only rationale to make an objection? And you heard from Howley and from Cruz to say, well, no, it's not. You also heard from Ron Johnson. And Ron Johnson, who's taken a lot of criticism over the years from a lot of different directions, I think on this matter...
He's taken the lead. He's done a great job.
Well, he's also, I think, taking the most electoral risk. I mean, the other senators that are have committed to lodge objections are from states that Trump won relatively easily. I can't think of a state other than Ron Johnson's Wisconsin where he didn't, with respect to the senators in question. And so I think there's less political risk for them. Ron Johnson not only taking political risk in Wisconsin, but also taking fire from that yapping little terrier on Meet the Press, Chuck Todd. Ron Johnson went straight at him over this weekend. And Johnson's position is similar to Cruz's, as you would expect. Look, address unanswered questions to restore confidence. That's the point. And this is why he held election fraud hearings, too. This is why he whistled in Christopher Krebs before his committee and so forth. And this is... How the interplay between Todd and Johnson went, with Chuck Todd accusing him of being the fire starter, now decrying the fire. Listen.
You're the arsonist here. President Trump is the arsonist here. Yeah. You've started this fire, and now you're saying, whoa, look at this. Oh, my God. All these people believe what we told them because you didn't have the guts to tell the truth that this election was fair.
Chuck, this fire was started back in January of 2017. People like Mark Zaid, in his tweet, the coup has started, first of many steps, rebellion and impeachment to follow ultimately. This was started when the mainstream media dropped any pretense of being unbiased and actually chose sides during this election. This fire was started when you completely ignored, for example, our investigation of Hunter Biden. You know, no evidence of wrongdoing there, and now we find out after the election, no, there is a fair amount of evidence to the point that we have a real FBI investigation.
Senator, so all right, it's I've had enough of media. Hearing
it's
this.
No, listen, I've had enough of this, too. It's
no,
the
Senator,
bias of the media
that has created a situation where
Republicans and conservatives do not trust the mainstream media, and that is what's that has destroyed the credibility of the media and our institutions and
the destruction
confidence in this election result.
And it continued right up until the end. One more exchange.
You got to ask yourself, when you tell people a million times that something was stolen or something was fraud, and then they believe it, I think you need to look in the mirror and ask yourself why so many people.
Well, Chuck, you need to look
in
your mirror and
say, Senator Johnson,
you
I've got to go. I appreciate you coming
Russian
on.
Collusion I've let you, with, I've let with you the Trump say campaign of, hoax. That is what you did in the media. You carried that water for years. You destroyed the credibility of press.
Senator
not
Johnson.
Me.
Yeah, I wish we got to get Senator Johnson back on. We'll let him complete a thought. The other thing I should say just on this too, that it's per what Johnson said, and this was in the letter that Ted Cruz authored. It's not just Republicans suggesting the election was rigged. Reuters Ipsos poll finds 39% of Americans surveyed say the election was rigged. That's, yes, two-thirds of Republicans that's driving it, but a third of independents and even a little bit more than a sixth of Democrats, 17% of Democrats say the election was rigged.
Yeah, because they can't believe 80 million Americans voted for Joe Biden.
I'm still having a hard time
processing that.
Yeah, I mean, the most shocking thing about that poll is that 17% of Democrats are honest. I had no idea. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app.
Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the things that we'll look back on in 2020 and into 21, particularly in big cities, but really generally, when we assess and historians assess our response to COVID-19, is they'll, I think we'll say, what a horrible mistake it was, what a silly thing they did out of fear to shut down K through 12 school systems around the country, what a terrible thing they did to the youth of the nation in that period. And that is not something we leave behind in 2020 in places like Chicago and New York and L.A., anywhere where you have
Democratic
socialist lordship. Right. And so you heard in Mike Scott's newscast all morning that many CPS teachers don't want to go back to work today. They don't want to go back to work a week from today. They don't want to go back to work until it's safe, as they so define it. That's the position of the Chicago Teachers Union. And it's certainly the position of Sarah Chambers, who has made news again. This is not the first time she's been in the news. It's just you just have to have a bit of institutional memory, which the Chicago Press Corps, like the D.C. Press Corps, is not real strong on, but we are here. You may remember the name Sarah Chambers from episodes like her serving as part of the CTU delegation to Caracas.
Yeah, she went to right.
Investigate the school system there. And sing the praises of Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro. That she was the same Sarah Chambers that was in the news last week for another reason.
Yeah, and in 2017, she was fired from CPS because she left her classroom and barged into other classrooms of other teachers and issued her own instructions to students. She interfered with statewide tests because she didn't believe they should take them. She participated in a scheme to remove and transport students without any chaperones who had been cleared by criminal background checks, because she wanted them to show up at her disciplinary hearing to support
and that
her.
And all of this has earned her a spot in the hierarchy of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Yeah, because she was reinstated in 2019 with the help of the union. So we've seen her before, and she decided, it's too scary to teach, Dan, but it's not too scary to travel, because she had an Instagram and Twitter, and she put, spending the last days of 2020 poolside, she wrote on a since-deleted Instagram post, we have the whole pool to ourselves. Then we're going to Old San Juan to get some yummy seafood, mofongo. And it's just so hypocritical.
She is let's understand something. She is the Chicago Teachers Union, a member of their executive board, and is an area vice president. So she is in the hierarchy of the Teachers Union. We're not just like cherry-picking some teachers and then trying to say, well, this is how all teachers are. And we're not even suggesting that all teachers are like Sarah Chambers, but we are saying that this is the posture of the Chicago Teachers Union, and she is an exemplar of that.
Right. And, a few hours before she posted this picture, pool life, you could see it, but it's been deleted. But people took, screensavers. Before that, sunbathing in a bikini, she rallied against reopening schools in Chicago because she deemed it to be too dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Because there's an inherent risk, Dan, when you leave your house, and the CDC advised people not to travel, especially to Puerto Rico, because COVID cases are high right now. And I caught so many teachers. I was on vacation with the family, and we went to Hawaii, and I caught so many teachers that were there that I spoke to. One was a selective enrollment to a Whitney Young High School, too afraid to teach, but not too afraid to travel. I said, all right, so you went to a crowded airport because the airports were packed. You got on a 777 that was completely sold out, and you're here, but you're too afraid to teach, where you have more control of the situation, where people are all wearing masks and you have HEPA filtration system, which is exactly what you have on a plane. So why are you too afraid to go back to school? It's like, well, I'm scared I'll bring something home to my 8-year-old who has asthma. I mean, this is just ludicrousy. Then I met another teacher from Wisconsin, same thing. And I confronted her and I took pictures of all these teachers. I haven't posted it yet, but they drive me nuts. I mean, these people feel so entitled and I can't stand it.
Well, what do we know? We know, for example, that in Chicago, between March 1st and December 29th of last year, there were 226 individuals, Chicago residents, under the age of 20 who died from COVID. 109 of the 226 died from homicide. There are 226 individuals under the age of 20 who died.
Okay. Not from COVID, but who died in Chicago.
Yeah. Under the age of 20, right. 220. 109 of the 226. 109 of the 226 from homicide. 40 from accident. 23 pending investigation. 16 from suicide. 11 from other natural causes. 5 from COVID.
And all of those 5 had other comorbidities.
We also know, because there's been a lot of study on this, right now you have about as close to a scientific consensus on this as you have on anything, that school is the safest place for kids, that kids, particularly in the primary grades, don't seem to get sick. And also don't seem to be transmitters.
They're not super spreaders like they thought that they might be.
Forget super spreaders. They don't seem to transmit the virus, generally speaking. Now, there are exceptions, of course. I'm speaking in general terms. So you can do a risk assessment, because nothing is without risk in this life. But generally speaking, that's what we know. We also know, because of the experience of two dozen Western nations that never closed their schools or closed their schools for very brief periods of time, that all of the apocalyptic predictions and the general fears as expressed by teachers union apparatchiks have no basis in reality. And yet here we are.
And they're supposed to return to school today to prepare for next Monday, January 11th. That's when pre-K and special ed return to high schools and middle schools. And they're already, the CTU is telling them, if you don't feel safe, don't go. That it's okay. Well, Janice Jackson better fire them, because the CEO of CPS said, if you do not have a valid note from your doctor, then you need to be in school. And if you're not, you're going to lose your job. And I want that to happen. Enough is enough already. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA. Then a quick comment. We got a letter, an email from Janice Jackson last night saying, despite the heroic efforts of our teachers to make remote learning a success, it simply cannot replace what students experience in the classroom. And she went on to say that 77,000 families want to see their children back in school, and cited, this HEPA filtration system and other, like Dr. Fauci said it's safe to go back. The CDC director said it's safe to go back. And they, looked at Chicago, the Catholic schools. The Catholic school system is working.
Yeah, the Catholic schools is a perfect example, because you have 34,000 city students in Catholic school that have been in school, and the teachers have been in school since the beginning August of the school year. I mean, some of them gone hybrid and so forth. But anyway, they're still much more present than obviously CTU and CPS, which has been absent from the classroom for 9 months. And so what do we know? Well, what do we know that the incidence is exactly what I described in Chicago, exactly what I described in other Western nations. What we know, generally speaking, is the situation in Chicago. If there were kids getting infected, if there were kids getting seriously ill, if there were kids getting dying, if there were kids transmitting, and a teacher got from a kid and then brought it home to her kid or to her mom or dad or so on and so forth, we would be hearing the excruciating details of every anecdote splashed across the pages of the dailies and on the network affiliate propaganda broadcast, because this is what they want to do. They want to induce fear. They want to whip frenzy. They want to support the position of the socialist apparatchiks in the Chicago Teachers Union and more generally. And they've been unable to do that because there are just no stories, are there?
Nothing to support it. And shame on CPS parents. Shame on them for not fighting harder for our children. I can't. Fox News has called me. Everyone's like, I need a CPS parent to talk about, such and such. You can't find a parent to go on camera because they're
shame
all
on
so
CPS
afraid.
Students for, shame on CPS students for sending their kids to CPS.
I know. Shame on us all. God, if I could have a do-over.
David and McCook.
Happy New Year's, guys. There's an article on WirePoint about Little Miss Sarah Chambers, and reading all the comments is a direct reflection on what a lot of people think about Chicago teachers and the union. They're getting raked over the coals. Check it out.
Thanks for the call, David. By the way, just a little bit of details, too, about those CPS teachers we're all paying to not be in the classroom. Average CPS teacher, 2019, $79,000. By 2024, under their new five-year contract, that will grow to nearly $100,000, $97,700 for the average CPS teacher by the end of their contract in 2024. Are you looking at a 24% raise in job guaranteed over the next five
years?
And
getting 16 weeks off a year? No, not. That's a good gig that they have. They should nullify that contract, by the way. If they don't show up for work, fire them all.
The average second-year teacher, $54,000. Average second-year teacher. By 2024, end of the five-year contract, the average second-year teacher will enjoy a 35% raise to $73,000. Average school nurse gets a 48% raise guaranteed over the next 5 years. Average teacher assistant gets a 31% raise. Does it sound similar to what you're guaranteed over the next 5 years in your job?
No. Good gig.
You want to compare to Catholic school? Well, not if you're a CPS defender. You know, I know they'll say, well, Catholic school teacher should make more. Well, I agree. I think everybody should make as much money as they can make. But there are economic realities that the Catholic schools have to face that, of course, the government schools don't. The minimum for a first-year teacher with a BA and CPS, the minimum, $60,000. The maximum for a teacher with a PhD and 30 years of service in the Catholic schools, $59,000. The minimum for a first year with a BA in CPS, $60,000. The maximum for a teacher with a PhD and 30 years in Catholic schools in Chicago, $59,000.
Ouch.
The maximum for a teacher with a PhD and 30 years of service in CPS, $140,000. About a $4 million guaranteed pension. Sure. Nothing to see here. Chip in St. Charles.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's so good to hear you guys again. I would just like to point out what the mantra is from the Chicago Teachers Union, that it's all about the children.
Of course
Never
it is.
Forget
they don't
that
care.
It's all about the children, and when they're marching through the streets and burning and looting, that it's all about the children.
Thanks for the call, Chip. Something else, too, because I don't want you to think that, oh, this is just dollars and cents. I'm just so cavalier. I'm against teachers making money. I'm anti-teacher and so on and so forth. All of the silliness that you get from the left when you try to have a intelligent conversation about what we're inputting and what we're outputting in K-12 systems, starting with Chicago. In 2019, 70% of black third graders failed to meet the state's expectations in English language arts. 83% of black eighth graders failed to meet the state expectations in English. 85% of black 11th graders failed to meet SAT expectations in English. For math, 80% of black third graders failed to meet. 87% of black eighth graders failed to meet. 87% of black 11th graders failed to meet. So they're doing a bang up job.
Yeah, let's give them a raise because that makes a heck of a lot of sense there, Dan.
So it's 85% of CPS students free or reduced school lunch. So poor minority children, which is a super majority of CPS students, they're being served well, or the adults at those salaries and discretion. You know, they forever get to. Define and redefine the conditions under which they'll work, regardless of the contract, regardless of the evidentiary basis in science. So who's getting served by the system again?
Nobody is.
Black kids? Well, Latino kids? Any kids? Any kids who aren't going to, you know, where the politicians send their kids? You know, the non-CPS schools. I'm talking about the Latins and the Francis Parkers and so forth. The lab schools. Who is getting served by the system? All of these heroic socialists who endlessly prattle on about people of color and equity and justice and opportunities for kids that have been denied opportunities and systemic racism. Well, who are the systemic racists? I say again, to borrow from Bill Buckley 35 years ago, the Ku Klux Klan could not design a more effective system than the Chicago public school system if the point was to keep minority children down. That's where CPS is has been for five decades, and it's where it is today. Despite all of the flowery workers of the world unite rhetoric from Sarah Chambers and the rest of them sunning themselves in Miami and Puerto Rico and Hawaii,
yeah.
While you're paying exorbitant property taxes to have your kids maleducated and at most turned into know-nothing Marxist activists.
And also, too, another thing that Sarah Chambers did, she said, I talked to so many of my students whose parents died during winter break. And I on Twitter, and now she does it, she blocked me, and actually she took down her account.
She blocked everybody.
Right, and she, but here's the thing. And I said, well, what are the names of these students' parents so we could pray for them? I want a list. And we could, you know, I can call the medical examiner's office, see what they, if they really died from COVID or not. And that's, I mean, that is just panic porn, bull jive that she did to push her narrative.
Well, this is
like
this
all
is the point.
Of her students' parents died over winter break. Give me a break.
You don't, excuse me, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez famously explained, when you're morally correct, you don't need to be specifically correct. So because Sarah Chambers is morally correct, it doesn't really matter if what she says is true. You understand? That's how it works. Chet and Lyle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning and happy new year. To the point of the St. Charles caller about it's all about the kids. 2 years ago, Lyle 202 had a reform slate of candidates run in addition to a binding referendum to reduce the taxes from the school district. The community, with the backing of the school board and the administration, rallied around Protect Lyle's Kids. And there was an organization called Citizens for Lyle Kids, and they crushed the reform slate and defeated the referendum. Fast forward to 2020, almost three quarters of the parents in 202 wanted their kids to go back to full-time in-person learning. And basically the school board did not have the will to take care, to address that.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, two of the leaders of the Citizens for Lyle Kids movement came before the school board and said, hey, we backed you. Where are you? Basically, they totally abandoned the people and totally turned back on their promise for protecting the kids. So
and
just an anecdote.
That's right. And the wheel keeps on turning in K-12 in Illinois. Thanks for the call, Chet. Just keeps on turning. By the way, one other individual I want to profile as well, in addition to the lovely Miss Chambers, the lovely Amy Jair Lyons. She is a English teacher at Lake Forest High School who has been too scared to come to the building. Because, by the way, these suburban schools, including in wealthy areas, are also, these suburban government schools are also, generally speaking, awful.
I know.
Awful.
Awful.
She is too afraid to come to Lake Forest High School to teach English, and what a treat that would be. But she was not too afraid to post on her social media, hanging out in South Beach, Miami, with the new love of her life, no masks, and enjoying life in a free state called Florida. Steve in Highland, Indiana.
Hi, yeah, I live here in Indiana. I was at a bar this weekend in Highland. And four Chicago school teachers sitting here drinking, but they can't go to work. And another thing, my next door neighbor is a county sheriff, hasn't went to work almost this whole time, but she's out running around shopping constantly. But she can't go protect the jail.
That's right. And thanks for the call.
And Highland, Indiana is my favorite town, by the way.
And of course, the people who can, many of the people who can afford to move, happen to be city and state employees of Illinois. I'm not going to live in the state. Yeah, no, I work for the state. I work for the county. I work for the school district. I'm not going to live there. Are you crazy? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Happy 2021. And a lot of unanswered questions from 2020, and some that at least the DC press corps stopped asking. that you think would be material to our response to COVID-19, our understanding of what happened, so that we can make better decisions prospectively, perhaps? Also, to hold people accountable who were bad actors, like, for example, I don't know, the Chinese Communist Party. Deputy National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger telling Pauls from around the world that intelligence points to the likelihood of the virus leaking from China's biggest lab, the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Oh, you mean it didn't come from the wet market?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the wet market.
There's a growing body of evidence that the lab is likely the most credible source of the virus, he said. Even establishment figures in Beijing have openly dismissed the wet market story, he added. But when Trump suggested that it, and this was, I thought, generous, that it was an accident. We don't know exactly if it, number one, we don't know if this is the source, but why are not we not asking questions? Why are we not investigating? You don't want to know the origination of this virus that has shut down the world? This is lunacy. Why? Because to ask questions of Chinese communists is what? Is racist? Is runs afoul of NBA protocols? I mean, what is it exactly? LeBron James doesn't want to know, so we don't want to know? I don't get it. So it's important that the Deputy National Security Advisor is briefing politicians from around the world on the topic, and that maybe we're zeroing in on this. And golly, I mean, it certainly was would be, since it's still pending, a wild coincidence that a level 4 virology lab in Wuhan is also the site of, or, you know, the proximity to the site where the virus first was recognized and ultimately spread. So important information, I would think. Shouldn't it inform our relationship with China? Shouldn't it inform our relationship with international quasi-governmental agencies like the World Health Organization that are predisposed to be beholden to China? For more on this and other such matters, please be joined again by our friend, Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, Happy New Year. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be with you. Hey, I just want to say people should remember the name Matt Pottinger. Matt was in the administration from the beginning. He's led on many of the Asia issues. He's probably the most effective, brilliant young leader the conservative movement has on foreign affairs in general, but on Asia in particular. And, you know, I think, and if there had been a second Trump term, he probably would have been the next national security advisor. So people should remember that name. That's a name to listen to and a voice to be respectful of.
But here's the problem, Jim. I think his career is going to be cut short because if what he's saying is true, that runs afoul of Richard Engel's reporting, and that is a crime that you cannot recover from.
Well, look, here's the important thing, which is we know that we cannot trust the Chinese Communist Party. There is already an overwhelming abundance of evidence to suggest that. So this is already a fact pre-established, that the Chinese Communist Party has only one interest, and that is the promotion and the sustainment and the expansion of their power and influence. We knew that before COVID. It's been demonstrated many, many times since. So the notion that the Chinese lie to us and that the Chinese Communist Party is just out for themselves, that shouldn't come as news to anybody. But this gets to the larger point of, where do we go from here? Because there are no do-overs in foreign policy and national security. And the reality is if you have an incoming Biden administration, if their notion is we have to figure out a way to accommodate and deal with the Chinese, the message to the Chinese Communist Party is the Americans aren't going to stand up to us. Let's just keep doing what we're doing.
Well, how can we make China pay for what they did, honestly? I mean, Richard Engel on NBC News, they had me convinced that, oh, it came from this wet market. But even, you know, according to Pottinger, officials in Beijing are saying that wet market story is false.
Well, you know, the way, you know, it's like when Trump said, well, we're going to make Mexico pay for the wall.
I mean, the people are going to interpret that literally. Nobody's going to walk up to the Chinese and write them a bill, and they're going to pay that bill. But Trump was making China pay in many, many different ways, including pulling out of the World Health Organization, which actually isn't even effective till the end of the year, so technically we're still in. But the Trump administration started creating alternative networks and systems to do global public health, really giving people an option, ways to do things without engaging with the Chinese. I think the same way with the clean networks. We're looking at consortiums of people who are doing stuff without Chinese technology. And these are ways of punishing that are going to cost China in the long term and really will make them pay a price for what they did. The reality is we are heading in the right direction, and changing course now is, again, like I said, we're just sending all the wrong signals to the Chinese. There is not a different way to deal with this country other than pushing back and defending our interests and our equities.
But here's the thing. Here's why. I mean, one of the reasons I would suggest why this story is so important. There are many. And I'll let you add to them. While the D.C. press corps is still trying to figure out who in the administration called COVID-19 the Kung Flu, because that's the real issue, now we have a situation where if it is ultimately proven or conceded that there was an outbreak, or perhaps even worse, maybe it was purposeful. I mean, I'm not putting anything past Chinese communists who put Muslim minorities in concentration camps. Okay, that's me. But if that is established, then it boxes the Biden administration in, because the outrage over the lying, one would think, in the Western world will be such that any weakness in the direction of China will be perceived as, you know, walking away from the calamity they visited upon the world.
Yeah, I would like that to believe that that's true, but I don't think it is. But people have found lots of ways to excuse Chinese behavior. And what we have seen is leaders have to stand up for nations to stand up. And what Trump was doing was pushing back. And a lot of the reason why a lot of world leaders didn't like Trump was because he was making them face hard truths that they really just wanted to look the other way and not face. I mean, this was particularly true in Europe. And so the reality is unless leaders lead, people will find ways to cave to the Chinese. Look, this isn't new. I mean, you know, do people forget Munich? I mean, European leaders were scurrying around figuring out ways to just accommodate Hitler, and maybe things were different. Not that I'm equating the Chinese and the Nazis, but the dynamics are the same. These are regimes that are just out for themselves. And if you accommodate them, what do you think they're going to do? And they want to create situations where they give you every reason to find an excuse not to do something. This is the Chinese way. This goes back to their ancient strategic philosophy of winning without fighting, which is you don't want to have a war with somebody. You want to convince them to just let you win. And this is the Chinese way. And if leaders don't lead, people will fall for it.
And investigators from the World Health Organization are going to be flying to Wuhan this week to investigate how the pandemic began. But is that just a waste of time since the Chinese pretty much own the WHO?
We don't know what we don't know. We don't know what kind of access we have, what information would be available to them. So it's very, very difficult to speculate. But, you know, I go back to, again, is if you need the origin of the Wuhan virus to convince you that the Chinese Communist Party is a danger to American interests, then there's, you've got a problem.
No,
the facts are already overwhelming.
Oh, of course, that's true. But I mean, that is not to say that identifying the origination of the virus is without import.
No, I think it is important. You know, for no other respects, that is a novel coronavirus. So how it evolved, regardless of the complicity of the Chinese or whatever, understanding how that virus evolved is important just from an epidemiological standpoint in terms of dealing with future outbreaks. So all that information is critical and vital. And so essentially what you have today is well over a year after the outbreak, the Chinese are contributing to perpetuating a global health crisis.
Right.
Speaking
of the topic and sort of the statement of principle you were making about leadership, you know, this is I know that health policy is not your area of expertise, but this has implications beyond that. This Christmas Eve interview, that Tony Fauci gave to the New York Times, in which he suggested that the estimate that he offered on herd immunity, the threshold for herd immunity, was, quote, partly based on new science and partly on his gut feeling that the country is finally ready to hear what he really thinks. He told the New York Times reporter, I'm quoting him, continuing to quote him, when polls said only about half of all Americans would take a vaccine, I was saying herd immunity would take 70 to 75%. Then when newer surveys said 60% or more would take it, I thought I can nudge this up a bit. So I went to 80 to 85%. Do you think that is appropriate to be tolerated by our elected officials from a public health official? Do you think that is the way that the leadership in a free society should communicate with its constituents? Do you think this enhances our domestic response to COVID-19 and thus our robustness across any measure, including our security the world over?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I have a long background in Homeland Security and these dealing with these large disaster issues and everything else. And the rule is always, the best rule is always the same, is you tell people what you know when you know it, right? So truth is really the best way to deal with that. And that's what people want. They want information that is credible. They want information that's actionable, and they want information that's understandable. And that should always be your criteria, whether it's a public health crisis or a hurricane or a natural disaster or a terrorist attack. So you know, the American people are grown-ups. I think you look at masks, you know, where we have this kind of Manichean thing where I'm not going to wear a mask or I'm going to wear a mask to bed, right? And the reality is this, that's not what the science says. And rather than just kind of tell people what the science says and let people make decisions, you know, we go into these Manichean positions of I need a mask, I don't need a mask. So I always think the best thing to do is just tell people what the science actually says.
Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. You know, you guys have the best show. You always get to the facts and the real issue.
Yeah,
thanks
we know.
For doing that.
Yeah. Dan's very humble.
Thanks, everybody. I want to make sure there's three people listening now. Thanks, okay. Guys.
Exactly.
Thanks, James. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, since our friend Jim Carafano brought up mask wearing.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, excellent use of the word Manichean rather than just saying black and white, which is what he was conveying with the whole mask binary. New song from Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
The combination of the artistry of Eric Clapton and Van Morrison.
Really?
Got to check this out. It's an anti-mask song.
Really?
An anti-mask song from these two, Hall of Fame artists. Listen.
Stand and deliver. You've let them put the fear on you.
Who's influenced?
Stand and deliver. But not a word you heard was true. But if there's nothing you can say, there may be nothing you can do. Do you wanna be a free man? Or do you wanna be a slave? Do you wanna be a free man? Or do you wanna be a slave? These chains until you're lying in the grave. I don't want to be a pauper and I don't want to be a prince. I don't want to be a pauper and I don't want to be a prince.
Yeah.
Are they burning
masks? I just
want
to do my job playing the blue for my friend. Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, the Constitution, what's it worth? You know they're gonna grind us down until it really hurts. Is this a sovereign nation or just a police state? You better look out, people,
before it gets too late.
How about it? Eric Clapton and Van Morrison. Van Morrison wrote, Eric Clapton singing, two 75-year-olds. I never thought I'd hear an Eric Clapton song that included the Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights, but you just
there
heard
you
it.
Go.
Yeah, how so, great was that? Yeah, I mean, it's not good. As good as cocaine, maybe, but it's still good.
Exactly.
That should be, this should be maybe a combined national anthem, an anthem for the West. How about just
right.
that, or at least for the UK and the US?
It's a lyric video right now, but I can't wait for them to make the actual video, and they should burn the masks in it. Don't you think that'd be good?
Yeah, that's a good start. It's not bad. I like it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and updating you on some of the new COVID lockdown strictures around the country, both actual as well as proposed. Manhattan Beach, California, removing all public seating, all park benches and seating in public, yeah. So that you stay locked in your home.
Right.
Give you a little bit more encouragement, since apparently Gavin Newsom hasn't been encouraging enough to this juncture.
Yeah, instead of they used to put crime scene tape on the benches and on the picnic tables outdoor. Now they're actually physically removing them.
Well, the suggestion had been made previously that restaurateurs should be held accountable for where their patrons eat when they pick up the food and go. So if they're congregating outside of their restaurant, or they're congregating in a public park, somehow the restaurateur is supposed to then take it upon himself to serve as a sentinel of the state and shoo people away. Get back to your home. Flee thee to a nunnery. It is remarkable, but that's not the most remarkable development I saw over the holidays.
What?
That comes from the other coast, New York State.
Oh, the Cuomo camps? COVID camps?
Cuomo COVID camps. This is legislation that has been filed in the State Assembly in New York. It is Assembly Bill A416, for those of you scoring at home.
Thank you, Dan.
Which, among other things, this is I'm reading from the language. Upon determining by clear and convincing evidence that the health of others is or may be endangered by a case, contact, or carrier, or suspected case, contact, or carrier of a contagious disease that, in the opinion of the governor, after consultation with the commissioner, may pose an imminent and significant threat to the public health, resulting in severe morbidity or high mortality, the governor or his or her delegee, including but not limited to the commissioner of the heads of local health departments, may order the removal and or detention of such a person or a group of such persons by issuing a single order, identifying such persons either by name or by a reasonably specific description of the individuals or group being detained, and so on and so forth. You get the picture. I think detention is the operative word in that legislative language. If only we had some historical precedents we could lean on for consideration of such a proposal as detention camps, where people can be detained and whisked away at the behest of the head of a state. God, are there any examples I can think of? So I just want to understand how this would work in practice, because concurrent to that story was a story in the New York Post over the weekend. Photos show thousands crammed into a Brooklyn synagogue for a funeral. New photos obtained by the Post showing thousands of maskless mourners jammed inside a Williamsburg synagogue for a funeral during the COVID pandemic. De Blasio were trying to get the truth of what happened here. We take this stuff very seriously and so on and so forth. So I just want to understand, if that legislation I referenced were made law in New York State, then these Jewish mourners could be rounded up as a group and put in a detention camp?
Oh, my God.
Any civil libertarians
that we weren't living in?
Any self-styled civil libertarians on the left? Is that raising any red flags for anybody?
Well, I went to Hawaii, and you have to get tested before you go. And then when you get there, you have to get tested again. And if you tested positive because it was a rapid test, they slap you with a red bracelet. They take you to your hotel and you have to stay in your room. And they have people outside to babysit you, to guard you. I mean, this is not in America. Who signed up for that?
Well, that is a kindler, gentler. That is a kindler, gentler detention. At least they're not inscribing the numbers permanently in your arm, at least not yet.
Really?
For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by David Marcus, who's the New York correspondent for TheFederalist.com. He's also a contributor to the aforesaid New York Post. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're a New Yorker.
How's it going?
Are you going to be lobbying for A416?
No, I won't be. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's the first thing that everybody in New York thought of when we saw this, because we know that both Cuomo and de Blasio have been going so hard against the Orthodox Jewish communities here in the city, who actually don't have who haven't had particularly staggeringly high rates of infection or death or anything. So yeah, it's frightening. I mean, what you're seeing at this point has moved into just mass hysteria. You guys mentioned the restaurants, right? New York City closed down indoor dining, I think it was about 3 weeks ago now, after it had been open for approximately 2 months, a little more. The New York Post and Republican politicians demanded from Cuomo that he release the contact tracing data that would show us exactly how much of a threat indoor dining was. So on the very day that he closed it down, he released that data, and 1.43% of all cases in New York State were traced to restaurants. 1.43%.
Just like
and
Illinois.
And he shut them down.
Yep.
I mean, it's unfathomable. And ultimately, and I think you guys are hitting on this too, this is no longer a story about science. This is all about politics and our constitutional rights and whether the American people are going to, you know, stand up for their own rights, because this is getting very scary.
And what about gyms? Aren't those closed as well? Because our contact tracing data that was released, less than 1%. Are associated with gyms and health clubs.
Yes, we had similar numbers. I believe our gyms are open. I'm not really a gym guy, but I believe our gyms are at least partially open. I think you have to wear a mask while you're working out. But, you know, nobody wants
to go back
downplay.
I want to go back to something you said, because this is just about power. This is just about politics, which is a synonym. This whole hand-wringing by the most political of actors on the national stage. It's sad that the vaccine has become political. It's sad that masks have become political. Actually, it isn't. Because if they don't become political, then free-loving people are just going to get steamrolled by these politicians.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, 110 years ago, the Irish writer William George Russell said, "Experts should be on tap, not on top." Mm-hmm. And it's really something that we need to think about now. We need experts. We love experts. It's incredibly important to have the information that they give us. They can't be our dictators. We have to take that information and then, as a free people, decide how we're going to react to that information. And in certain states like yours, like mine, like California, that is not what's been happening. We've had these insane regulations that obviously aren't working. I mean, I saw Fauci on TV yesterday saying, well, you know, if it gets worse, we may have to go into lockdowns in places like California. May have to.
May have to. Living under a rock?
About?
He's like Crocodile Dundee. That's not a lockdown. I'll show you a lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me. And you know, Newsom's approach seems to be, this isn't working, let's do more of it. And I also want to say, what I was going to say about, you know, nobody wants to downplay this, because obviously this is a terrible disease and we've lost so many people to it. But what's happening in California right now is bad, but it's not comparable to what happened in New York in April. I the highest death toll that we've seen in all of California, which is more populous than New York, is about 98. Back in April, we were seeing 1,000 people a day dying in New York State. Mm-hmm. So we're in a very different place with this disease. We have vastly more treatments. We're not putting people on ventilators. It's serious. It certainly is. But it's not where we were in April. And so to react to it even more harshly than we did in April just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's right. But all of this stuff is immaterial. I mean, it doesn't matter if Fauci says that I was giving numbers based on where I thought public opinion was, what I thought the American people would handle, and I'll move those numbers around depending on what I think the American people can handle and when. It doesn't matter that Dr. Birx says that going home to winterize my house in Delaware somehow is not the same thing as traveling for the mere mortals over which she lords as well, and then she has to resign amid the pressure from this controversy. Oh, it's so sad. She's the victim in all of this. We have placed this actually a misunderstanding of science, like it's a thing rather than a process. But we've placed this word science on the top of a mountain over to which we all bow. And so anything that anybody does invoking science, particularly when it's imposing will, is acceptable no matter how hypocritical they behave. Gavin Newsom, another good example. De Blasio, another good example. It doesn't matter. None of the data doesn't matter to half the population, at least. The hypocrisy doesn't matter. Anything under the rubric of science is enlightened.
Yeah, but I mean, that would be bad enough. I mean, that would already be a bad situation, but it's even worse than that because Scott Atlas is a scientist, right? We have all kinds of scientists who are saying this is a really bad idea. And those people are mocked. Those people are silenced, except for on certain outlets or in certain outlets. If you try to talk about comparing the data between places like Florida and Texas and New York and California, where the states that were more open are clearly doing better, both in terms of COVID and obviously economically, that's apparently not science.
Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, was, the New Republic's, evil person of the year. You're right. It's worse than that. It's sort of the idolatry of this concept of science, as however it's defined, combined with the all of the institutional power of the left in media and cultural institutions, marginalizing anybody who dares to, cross their power grab.
Yes, absolutely. And the precedent that it is laying down really should scare every American because, and I think we may have talked about this on your show before, but this is not only not the last pandemic we're going to face. This is not the last public health crisis. And remember those words, right? Because
yes.
We have states that have called racism a public health crisis, mm-hmm. but climate change is a public health crisis. So if the rule now is if we have a public health crisis of climate change, then my goodness, that means we have to suspend some constitutional rights. We're in for a long ride here and an ugly and bumpy one.
Can you imagine what the reaction would be in this time in America if the median age of death was under 50? And if the mortality rate was instead of, 0.1%, it was 1%. Can you imagine what we'd be North Korea.
Yeah, I think that's right. In March, I have a book called Charade about the pandemic and the lockdowns that's coming out. And one of the things that I talk about is the 1968 Hong Kong flu pandemic that killed 100,000 Americans. And I mean, that's something that up until this year, very few people who weren't alive then even knew happened. Mm-hmm. It was horrible, but obviously we didn't do anything like this, right? We had political conventions, we had concerts, we had, it was the height of the 60s in the middle of this pandemic. So to look at what we're doing now in comparison to that, is bizarre, and it is a North Korean model. It is a Chinese model. It is ultimately a communist model that we need to resist.
Well, we didn't have social media back then, because I blame that. You know, both spreading false information and scaring people, really.
Yeah, and again, on the flip side of it, censoring information that, you know, might calm people down a little bit.
Yeah, I think that latter point is the big point. And so just on that sort of a jumping off point, specifically Josh Hawley, what do you think? It's almost separate and distinct from objecting to the electoral count on Wednesday. It's Hawley using that as another opportunity to pound big tech, and that's why he's separated from those other 11 senators led by Ted Cruz that are calling for this election commission. Just sort of the philosophy of taking every opportunity that anyone has to raise the specter of what big tech, the power big tech wields. More powerful than, frankly, the government. We spend so much time talking about government, and we spend some time, but it doesn't seem enough time talking about corporate America generally and big tech specifically.
Yeah, I mean, look, for big tech and big corporations, this has been such an enormous windfall. In March, I had a dry cleaner and tailor that I went to on my corner. By next week, that's going to be a Popeyes. That's happening all over the country. That was an immigrant-owned small business. Now, this might be a franchise, right? But that's not the same thing. These are independent businesses. And as far as big tech goes, there's an enormous conflict of interest because they make so much money from people being locked in their homes that if they are also the ones who are deciding what can and cannot be shared through social media, you know, taking orders from the Chinese government in terms of like what shows up on the news, it becomes a perfect storm. That's absolutely in their benefit. And so Hawley's exactly right that we need to focus on big tech and come to understand just how powerful they really are right now.
He is David Marcus. He's the New York correspondent for TheFederalist.com. He's also a contributor to the New York Post. David, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So tomorrow is the all-important Georgia Senate runoff elections. Tonight, President Trump will be in Georgia rallying Trump supporters to ensure that they vote tomorrow because it looks to be a turnout game. I mean, the scuttlebutt has been that the RNC is very confident that David Perdue is going to win, and they easily was the adverb that I heard. And that Kelly Loeffler is also up a bit on Warnock. That doesn't really comport with the most recent Trafalgar polling I've seen, which has it statistically a dead heat. And I mean, you know, 50-49 type dead heat.
And Senator Perdue, he's still in self-quarantine, you know, after one of his campaign workers tested positive for COVID. So that can't help if you're not out, you know, pressing the flesh.
Well, so Trump will make it unequivocal, as he did a couple of weeks ago, that people need to get out and support Perdue and Loeffler and put them over the top so that Republicans retain control of the Senate. But I wonder how the coverage of the conversation between Trump and his legal team and Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and his legal team over the weekend will be received and how it will impact the election amid all the calls from, you know, political sophists like our own Sack of Durbin to suggest that Trump's admonishments of Raffensperger to examine the areas where the Trump campaign has identified votes that shouldn't be counted, election irregularities, fraud, if you will, that it amounts to criminal activity, a criminal solicitation to commit election fraud is what, of course, the left is trying to spin from this comment that Trump made during their hour-long conversation.
The people of Georgia are angry. And these numbers are going to be repeated on Monday night, along with others that we're going to have by that time, which are much more substantial even. And The people of Georgia are angry. The people of the country are angry. And there's nothing wrong with saying that, you know, that you've recalculated.
Well, Mr. President, the challenge that you have is the data you have is wrong.
Look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
And that is being interpreted, of course, in the worst possible way, like the do me a favor line in the Zelensky call that led to the House Democrats impeaching Trump. Being interpreted as some, again, solicitation, criminal activity, and extra blackmail, and so on and so forth. When, in point of fact, and by the way, this is included in Fox News reporting at the top of RR, which was a terrible report. Yeah, I don't know which report. That's ridiculous. She misunderstands it, just as the Democrats are purposely misunderstanding it, that Trump is suggesting somehow, you know, we lost by 12,000 votes, so now you need to find 12,000 votes. That's not what he was saying. If you look at the transcript or listen to the entire conversation leaked to the Washington Post, you hear him going through, over the course of that hour, specific batches of votes that they believe were counted improperly, whether it is people who died and there's a dispute about how many people dead voted, whether it's people who moved out of state and there's a dispute about that, whether there's people who didn't properly sign the absentee ballot application, and so on and so forth. He talked in that same hour-long conversation, Trump said, I think I won Georgia by 500,000 votes. So what he's saying is, all I need is 12,000 from the hundreds of thousands I actually won the state by. You don't need to do the whole thing. Just look at a few categories of what I'm saying, and you'll find what we found, what our election experts found, what those who audited our findings found. And just to point this out from the attorneys, because this won't be covered anywhere else, maybe by some of our colleagues on Salem, but certainly not by the D.C. Press Corps. Cleta Mitchell, who, as I've said before and will say again, you've heard her on this show, is one of the preeminent election attorneys in D.C., quoting her to the Raffensperger and his team. You have data and records that we don't have access to, and you keep telling us and making public statements that you investigated this and nothing to see here, but we don't know about that. All we know is what you tell us. Then her colleague, also a Trump campaign attorney, Kurt Hilbert, goes on to say, look, quote, just four categories that have already been mentioned by the president that have actually hard numbers of 24,149 votes that were counted illegally. That in and of itself is sufficient to change the results or place the outcome in doubt. We would like to sit down with your office and we can go and we can do it through purposes of compromise. And just like this phone call, just to deal with that limited category of votes. And if you're able to establish that our numbers are not accurate, then fine. So all of this bluster surrounding this conversation because of the way Trump talks, and if you actually drill down to what his legal representatives are saying, that's what you get from Cleta Mitchell and Kurt Hilbert. But how will this play, all of this play, and what can we expect tomorrow with so much hanging in the balance? And
the battle for America.
It really is basically yeah. That. For more on this, we'll get some local expertise. We're pleased to be joined by Janelle King. She's the co-founder of Speak Georgia, and she's also the former deputy state director for the Georgia Republican Party. Janelle, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So how are Georgia Republicans receiving this latest contretemps over the Trump Raffensperger call?
What's so funny is that I don't think I've talked to one Republican about it because we're all numb to the Democrat hit pieces. You know, I think at this point they have taken the entire 4 years that the president was in office and made it about him, you know, doing things that we know he wasn't doing and just kind of highlighting information and highlighting stuff to create distractions. And so we're pretty much numb to it. You know, with this call here, I'm not surprised that the Democrats are taking it and trying to spin it in a way that makes it look like the president is doing something criminal, when in fact, everything he said in that call is something that he tweeted out at least once before. So there was nothing there, and we're not even talking about it or addressing it. Right now, we're focused on the Senate race, and the Senate race is the only thing we're focused on because what we know is that our country is at stake. And if we do not make a decision and make the right decision to support Senator Loeffler and Senator David Perdue tomorrow, saying we are handing this country over to the Democratic Party.
Well, you know,
What is the state of affairs, though, with the local Republican Party? Because that matters. And you know, I just Trump referring to himself in that same call as a schmuck for supporting Brian Kemp. Obviously, we know what his opinion of Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger is and the job that both of them have done. I mean, I'm not nearly as hard on Kemp as the president is wont to be. But does that have a depressive effect at all, do you think, in terms of turnout, the squabbling going on between Trump and particularly Kemp?
I hope not. You know, what I'm thinking, though, is that, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who feel a certain type of way, whether they support the president or Governor Kemp or like myself, support both of our leaders. However, I do know that one thing we all believe and we all understand is that this race is important. And so I truly believe that people are going to turn out to vote and they're going to show up on election day and we're going to bring this home. However, I do know that, you know, like all families fight sometimes, you know, and there's disagreement. And one thing this shows is that when the Democratic Party tries to paint a picture that we are all walking in lockstep with the president or lockstep with whoever our leaders are, no, we are independent thinkers and we have these discussions. That's where disagreement comes from. But at the end of the day, we all can share. We all want election integrity, and we want to feel like our vote is free and that it's taken and done fairly. And so that's something that's universal. And so how we get there may differ, but we definitely have the same end goal, and I believe that's going to be reflected tomorrow.
So Stacey Abrams was on This Week with Martha Raddatz, and she said the Democrats in Georgia, the DNC, they've registered 65,000 voters, people under the age of 29, people of color who did not vote in the general election. What has the Republican Party done in Georgia to get people registered to vote?
So we are always registering people to vote. I know that our governor now, former Secretary of State, Governor Kemp, put in place a process where once you get your driver's license, you're automatically enrolled. And so that also plays into that. And you have to keep in mind that some of these voters are under the age of 18 that Stacey Abrams is referring to. So she can put these numbers out there all day long, but the real number that matters is how many of them can actually vote. And so we are definitely, you know, pushing our own efforts as well. I do feel that is a area that the Republican Party can definitely strengthen going forward, but we are excited about what's happening. Again, Stacey Abrams is definitely doing all that she can do. I'm not convinced or I'm not impressed, to be honest, with her actions because some of her strategies seem to be beyond pandering and a little insulting, being that Georgia holds the most business, African Americans and business-driven and successful minorities in the country are right here, yet some of their ads pander to this mindset that all African Americans are struggling and just need that handout, and that's not the case. So her efforts are not impressive on my part.
Well, what is happening in Georgia then? Is it just the nature of all of this change in election protocols and the drop boxes and so forth? Because it is remarkable. It's one thing for, you know, Georgia to be close. It's another thing for Warnock and Ossoff, who are so far left in addition to all of their infirmities. Warnock has personality and Ossoff has Chinese communist ties. Remarkable that they could be in statistical dead heats with the two incumbents, isn't it?
It is. And the thing is, though, the Democrats who are voting in this race and voting for those candidates are not necessarily voting for Ossoff and Warnock. They're voting for Stacey Abrams and they're voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and everyone else who has been able to propagandize them into thinking that this is what's best for them. It's not a situation where we have two candidates on the left that are strong candidates. And we knew that from the very beginning. And I believe that that's going to be their downfall. The Democratic Party has, to me, in my opinion, hasn't done a good job of picking good candidates in a very long time. So, you know, but what they did do was create this referendum against the president. And then they created this notion and this perception and narrative that all Republicans are racist and that all Republicans simply want to, you know, destroy your life. When in fact, that is their strategy and their narrative that they have. And so more than anything else, what I'm seeing is, like I said, the referendum on the president and the referendum on the Republican Party as a whole. And then they are getting more and more people out to vote that doesn't typically vote due to their increased efforts. And when you can raise $100 million in 3 months, and there's a lot that you can do as far as spreading messaging, whether it be true or false.
So what happens tomorrow? Because the early voting I saw, or the voting numbers I saw last week, suggest that the turnout was better for Democrats than it was in advance of the November 3rd election. Now, again, you can only read so much into early voting numbers, but it does suggest that a big Election Day turnout is necessary for Perdue and Loeffler.
You know, that is actually the position that we're used to being in. You know, going back, it's other races. We are we typically show up on Election Day, and so I would rather be in this position where I see that, in my opinion, I think around 80% of Democrats have already, you know, cast their vote. So we kind of know where they stand. So this now leaves the ball in our court, and it's really up to Republicans to get out the vote. And that's it. There's no other way that we can lose this other than not showing up. And so I think that's a good position to be in. It's tricky and it's risky, of course. But it's definitely the best position to be in at this time.
Well, 3 million people have already voted early. Are you confident that there won't be any voter fraud? I mean, considering the fact that 1,700 Georgians voted twice, they mailed in their ballots and then went to, you know, the polling places on Election Day, and nothing's happened to them. They haven't been arrested or charged with any voter fraud. But are you confident that this will be an honest election?
You know, I'm hopeful that it will be an honest election, and I'm hopeful that, you know, I know that both senators have put a lot of energy and a lot of effort into making sure that they have people on the ground who are watching this process very closely. We have to keep in mind that we know better now than what we did in November, and so there are definitely new strategies being implemented. So I would hope that the Democratic Party wouldn't cheat this go-round, but should they, I am confident that we are putting forth our best effort to catch it and to be ahead of it.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but what is new for tomorrow that wasn't in place for November 3rd?
Well, I know there was a lot of talk about poll workers, and we personally have 8,000 poll watchers that are already being deployed to go out and watch these days, which is more than what we had in November. So we definitely increased that. Our poll watchers are now on high alert because of everything that's happened. I think that also created an education towards our poll watchers and our attorneys to be able to look for smaller things that they may not have noticed in the first go round. So I do feel hopeful about that. But most importantly, there is no argument if we don't show up. So not voting is not an option. And I believe that as long as we show up and we go ahead and we press those numbers, I think we'll be fine. One of the things I looked at is I know we are down by, I think we're down by about 20, a little over 20% in turnout overall than in November. And then the mail-in ballots, which is where we saw most of the fraud, is also down about 20%. So if we look at it from that perspective, if they did cheat in the same way that we believe they did beforehand, it would take almost twice the effort to do so. And I'm pretty sure that we're in place to be able to catch that.
What about, like, Andrew Yang encouraged people to move to Georgia temporarily? You know, if you can work from home, just move to Georgia, live there, establish residency, and then vote in the election. Is anybody checking that?
Absolutely. So when that first happened, I do know, and I will give our SOS credit for that, is that they did jump on that fairly quickly. They made it very clear that they are watching all of these new registrants, and that if you are found to have moved here simply to vote, then you will be federally prosecuted. I'm prosecuted with a felony. And so I know that has went out. And then I personally had people messaging me that was getting letters from some of these organizations that were outside of the state that were encouraging people to you know, go online and register to vote. And then one of my friends received a letter from someone who had passed away in Alabama, and we jumped on that fairly quickly. And then I also know that that the SOS office has been investigating a lot of these nonprofit organizations that are coming from outside of the state as well, that's encouraging people to you know, operate in irregularities. So I think that we are in a good position.
Well, Andrew Yang, if he gets a felony conviction, that'll help him run for mayor of New York City. So we'll have to see how that plays out. Janelle King, co-founder of Speak Georgia, former deputy state director for the Georgia Republican Party. Janelle, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yep, and she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we find ourselves on Jan 4 in much the same position we were before the holidays, with the exception of some avenues of dispute resolution being foreclosed to the Trump campaign. But the January 6th vote counting exercise by Congress is not going to be without some drama, thanks to the announcement that some 12 U.S. senators and more than 100 Republican members of the House are going to lodge objections to the electoral, to the electors, to the count from some, at least some of the states in controversy. Explaining that over the weekend was one of the senators objecting, Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who tried to make the case to that yapping terrier who hosts Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, as to why this is right and proper, building upon actually the election fraud hearing he had before the holidays in the committee that he chairs in the House, Homeland Security, Ron Johnson.
One of the points we make is that we are not acting to thwart the democratic process. We're acting to protect it. The fact of the matter is that we have an unsustainable state of affairs in this country where we have tens of millions of people that do not view this election result as legitimate. We've just come off of 4 years where the other side refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of President Trump. And here we are again. And what we're saying is we need transparency. And you do not, when you're trying to investigate wrongdoing in elections, you don't have very much time. And so what we're suggesting is let's set up a commission as they did. I know it's a long time ago, 1877, but let's take a look at a bipartisan commission to organize all the allegations. Certainly what I did in my hearing is a 3.5-hour hearing. We barely scratched the surface, but organize the allegations. Let's take off the table the ones that have been explained, but also acknowledge the problem areas that have not been explained so that we can restore confidence in our election system.
Of course, referencing the commission after the 1876 election between Hayes and Tilden, right, that was disputed.
You were in junior high school, course, that year, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I was too young to fully appreciate the precedent that was set. Ron Johnson, then, of course, based on what you just heard from him, which may sound reasonable to you, that was met with the customary ridicule from Chuck Todd.
Then why didn't you hold hearings about the 9/11 truthers? There's plenty of people who thought 9/11 was an inside job. So what you're basically saying is that there's enough people who believe in conspiracy theory.
If there's enough people who hold, figured it was the most relevant issue.
Are you going to do it? How about the moon landing?
Obviously, are you going to hold hearings on that?
So holding hearings on election fraud or objecting and suggesting that an election commission, bipartisan election commission, be appointed, regardless of whether or not you want to argue the constitutional propriety of it, that is tantamount to holding a hearing on, you know, the moon landing occurred on a soundstage, or that 9/11 was an inside job. For reaction to that characterization and what it implicates about where we are, we're pleased to be joined by Daniel Oliver, former general counsel at the Department of Education, chairman of the FTC, and executive editor of National Review, currently chairman of the Education and Research Institute. Daniel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So is what Ron Johnson, Ted Cruz, and a dozen senators, what they're proposing, is that the equivalent of having a hearing on conspiracy theories around the moon landing or 9/11?
No, I think it's just the Democrats, again, trying to obfuscate the matter, because a lot of people really believe the election was stolen. If you look at the figures, it's about 39% of Americans think the election was, quote, stolen. 67% of Republicans, 17% of Democrats, and 31% of independents. That's a lot of people now who don't trust the electoral process, and it makes it difficult to run a country in a democratic way when you've got that many people not trusting how the process operates. You think the Democrats might be interested in looking into it too, but they're not, because I think they understand the numbers, and that the numbers, I think, clearly indicate that there was a certain amount of fraud in the election, and that obviously will tend to make Biden an illegitimate president, as indeed they tried to make Trump illegitimate.
Yeah, and that-
well, I think one of the things though too is just the left's posture, as we've heard for much of the time, except when the results go against them, as in 2016 or 2004, is that voter fraud in and of itself is a conspiracy theory. Voter fraud doesn't occur.
Yeah, I mean, and of course that's nonsense. It does occur, but there are a couple of other aspects to the whole business. The sort of three aspects of the voting business. One is fraud. People bring in ballots in suitcases in the middle of the night. People changing ballot paper ballots. That's one kind. A second kind is the statistical anomalies we saw, and I wrote a piece about that. That the absentee ballots, normally they get rejected at 3%. Now in this election, some of them got rejected at 0.6%. That's possible, but it's most unlikely. And so if we live by statistics, when we charge police, the police with discriminating on the basis of race, or if we charge banks with not giving loans because they're discriminating on the basis of race, we don't actually find a banker who says, yes, and I discriminated. They look at the numbers, and the numbers show that blacks don't get loans at the same rate as whites and say that's discrimination. Well, if that's discrimination, why isn't voting by, why aren't votes that come in disproportionate numbers without being challenged, why isn't that the same kind of statistical anomaly that we should challenge?
So what did you make of the one-hour phone call between President Trump and the Secretary of State of Georgia?
Well, I don't know about that. I think the real point is to focus on the numbers. And here's another point about the elections, which I think is important, which has nothing to do with gumshoe work, nothing to do with private detectives looking through windows and finding people stuffing ballots into suitcases. That is the kind of thing that happened in Pennsylvania, where they changed the election procedures by legislation, not by constitutional amendment. The Democrats don't want to talk about that. Talk to your friends. You know, always talk about how the suitcases didn't have ballots in them. But in the case of Pennsylvania, it's right on its surface. You see that what they did is not what they were supposed to have done. Pennsylvania Constitution says you can only change the election process by a constitutional amendment. They changed it by mere legislation. That means that those votes are simply illegal, and you don't have to find a guy with a mask crawling around under a table at midnight to say that. It's right in his face. But the Democrats don't want to talk about that.
I want to go back to the statistical anomalies issue, because it's something people have pointed to for many weeks now. And you're right, of course, that the left will use the racial disparities, and the example you use, banking, to say, well, that's the only explanation possible is systemic racism. There's no consideration for other variables, like, for example, creditworthiness,
right,
when it comes to loans. But I also don't want to fall into their trap of manipulating statistics in the way that Mark Twain described. So, for example, what you talk about absentee ballots and the spoilage rate, it's possible that because of the convenience of ballot drop boxes, because of the education about how to fill out absentee ballots and so forth, that despite the dramatic increase in turnout, that there was less errors committed by voters across the nation. That's possible. But it's one of those things where if you want to address the statistical anomaly the way that I just addressed the banking statistical anomaly, you have to raise an explanation. And I don't hear an explanation. I just hear dismissal of this as, you know, as conspiracy mongering or trying to disenfranchise somebody, rather than looking for an explanation of why something so unusual occurred. Exponentially more absentee ballots, for example, and by a multiple, a much lower spoilage rate.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it is, as even the people who have brought those statistics to the fore have said, it is statistically possible. Anything is possible. But in the normal course of business, if your life depended on it, and the life of the Constitutional Republic does depend on it, you would take a better look at it. You wouldn't get into a spaceship with those statistical anomalies. You'd say, wait a minute, I'm going to check on this because I don't want to fly this boat if it's got those kinds of problems. So you would look at it, but the Democrats don't want to look at it because I think because they know what they'll find. But you're exactly right. Those statistical anomalies, they're everywhere and they should be investigated.
And another one that you point to in your piece at the American Conservative is turnout. We talked about this on the show, too, is it's possible with same-day voter registration that some precincts in Milwaukee County could have had 120, 150, 180% turnout. Everybody turned out, and then a bunch of other people equal to the number of registered voters also registered that day to vote in Milwaukee County and that precinct. That's possible. But is that what happened? You don't get an answer to that question. You're trying to disenfranchise people, black people in urban centers.
Right.
No, I'm asking a question about how you got 200% turnout. That's a neat trick. How'd you do it?
Exactly. Well, that's exactly right. They don't want to look at the facts. We all know what's going on here. That's the issue. That's why, as I say, 39% of Americans don't think that the election was fair. And you would think that, except you don't understand why, you think that everybody would have an interest in getting to the bottom of it so that people can trust the elections. But they don't. The Democrats don't have any interest in getting to the bottom of it because they know what happened. And they want to roll right over America. And in that sense, that's a revolution. And it seems to me we're going to have one kind of revolution or another, and we don't know which it's going to be yet.
What's your perspective on sort of the precedent-setting arguments going in opposite directions? Tom Cotton arguing that it's a dangerous precedent to lodge these objections, as has been proposed, telegraphed by Cruz and others. And Cruz, and as you heard Ron Johnson saying, we're basing our precedent on what was done in 1876. And, oh, by the way, it is worth noting that in both 2004, with respect to the outcome in Ohio, and 2016, there were Democrat members of Congress who lodged objections to the results as well. So there's this no constitutional crisis or precedent that we're creating here.
No, there certainly is not, and I think it's important to do it. It's important to do it because you should always be looking for the truth. So the idea that it is disruptive, yes, to that extent, Senator Cotton is correct, but when you have an election like this, a disruptive election like this, it should be investigated. I think he's wrong. I think that this needs to be aired. Indeed, it needs to be aired so that those Americans who can be satisfied by what happens in Congress, by what will happen in Congress, can be satisfied. I don't think everybody's ever going to be satisfied, but it might be that by lodging the objections and discussing them openly and looking at them intelligently by both parties, a lot of those people who don't think the election is fair now can come to believe it is fair. If you sweep it under the rug, hide it, my guess is that you'll have more people who will think the election is unfair.
Daniel Oliver, former general counsel at the Department of Education, chairman of the FTC, executive editor for National Review, and now chairman of the Education and Research Institute. Daniel Oliver, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, if Joaquin Phoenix doesn't want to do a sequel to The Joker, I think I got the guy to backfill his role.
Well, I always watch the CNN, you know, ball drop at Times Square. Andy Cohen, Anderson Cooper, you know, they do shots throughout the night.
Ball
you see
drop.
A different.
Interesting choice of
thank
words.
Thank you. You see a different host. Side of Anderson Cooper. And they had Snoop Dogg on after midnight, and they played the, you know, have you ever gotten high at, you know, the Oscars or the Grammys? And you know, they asked him a question, and the person laughing in the background, yes, Anderson Cooper.
Have you
yes.
gotten high on CNN?
No, but in front of the CNN building on Sunset Boulevard, I have.
Snoop, have you gotten high at the DMV?
That would be a no. That would be a no-no.
Let me ask you this, and then I'm going to wrap out of this game. Have you gotten high at a Brit?
That's chilling. It's blood curdling.
Have
yes,
you?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. No. Wow.
Yes.
That's incredible.
This is the dog of all dogs we're talking about, Andy.
You're right,
in
though.
Addition to
like
not
Joker.
Knowing, in addition to not knowing that Snoop Dogg was still alive, I am that laugh will haunt me. That is
Dan,
considerably more frightening than Heath Ledger or Joaquin Phoenix. I'll tell you that.
Ooh, I'm glad you don't laugh like that.
Did Don Lemon get drunk and profess that he's ready for a relationship this year? I missed it.
No, he wasn't in it this year. I'm sorry.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.